Voices in Exile. Like refugees everywhere, the people from El Salvador are messengers of bad news. Unable to survive in their country, they are unwanted in the United States. They blend into the Latin neighborhoods of major cities, New York, Washington, Los Angeles, San Francisco. To North Americans, these Salvadorans are an invisible people. In this four-part series, Salvadoran refugees tell what they have seen and heard, what's happened to them. They speak of life and death in their war-torn country, their flight to the United States, and their struggle to remain here. Behind the headlines, the facts and figures are the people whose country is a killing ground. In this program, Search for Asylum, we hear of their attempt to gain legal status as refugees in this country. Voices in Exile, they speak of their search for asylum.
I imagined in a certain way that if the immigration authorities saw me, they would kill me, the way it happens in my country. Because if after 6 p.m. you're outside in the street, they shoot at you to kill. One carries that in one's mind. One carries a very strong tension. In a way, it's true because if I'm deported, I would be dead upon arrival in El Salvador.
The estimates of refugees seeking safety from El Salvador to the United States are between 350,000 to 800,000. And they've arrived basically since late 1979. San Francisco, the guesstimates are between 50,000 to 85,000 refugees from El Salvador have sought safety.
The civil war in El Salvador has uprooted a quarter of its population of 5 million. People from rural areas usually flee to the city of San Salvador or to refugee camps across the border in Honduras. It is mainly working and middle-class people from urban areas who make it to the United States. They try to remain unnoticed among other Latinos, for if identified and arrested, they face possible deportation. Although at least 50,000 unarmed civilians have been killed in their country since the Civil War began, the U.S. State Department contends that Salvadorans who come here are economically motivated immigrants, not refugees running for their lives. Dolores Ferguson of the Central American Refugee Program and David Ilkert, Northern California head of the INS, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, speak to this issue.
The vast majority of the refugees that come in are undocumented. They're not immigrants. They're not coming by choice, as most immigrants do. This is a situation of people fleeing for their lives. They're not able to get visas to come in. So most of the refugees enter the United States without papers.
They're here because of economic... I'm convinced that most El Salvadorians are here for economic reasons, period. Their basic ground, in most instances, there's a war going on down there. People are being killed. They can't find jobs. And they say for economic reasons, they just don't want to live in El Salvador, or they can't make a living. Well, there's nothing... You will not find the word economics mentioned in the definition of refugee contained in the Refugee Act of 1980.
We hear many times the Salvadoran refugees characterized as economic refugees. I think that should be examined real closely. In our program experience, that certainly has not been true. And we're seeing now about 40 new refugees per week and have interviewed in-depth thousands and thousands of newly arrived Salvadoran refugees. And over again, we're hearing instances of persecution. Many times, the most horrible types of persecution. Some of our clients have been victims of torture, and their very bodies are witness to the fact that they have been persecuted. That is not an economic reason to come to the United States.
They're human beings, and once they've had experienced the good life in the United States, they're going to elect to try to stay in the United States by whatever means they can.
Some of the refugees are university professors. That's a highly vulnerable group. They had homes in El Salvador, professions, very prestigious jobs, good income. They left that all behind to come here and for survival are working as a janitor. the refugees are political refugees. They are fleeing political persecution.
The INS has been catching and prosecuting increasing numbers of Salvadorans. It has deported more than 33,000 back to their country, although that is prohibited by the 1967 Geneva Accord on Refugees. The story of Jorge, who lives in San Francisco, is a case in point.
I've been in this country illegally for 4 years. I've been working, you know. I don't have a social security card or any of that. I have found a place to live, but I'm not safe anywhere because I am illegal. Who knows, perhaps the immigration can come to fetch me at home or at work. They might make me sign, and I'll have to return to El Salvador. I was on Valencia Street. I was trying to help another person push a car. Then the car was making a great noise and it didn't have a front bumper. I went around and pushed the car from behind where it did have a bumper. I was on the wrong side of the street. I don't know where he came from. The police arrived, bam, with lights and all. I thought, for sure they're going to give me a ticket. That's the first thing I thought. He's going to give me a ticket for doing this. He only asked, "What are you doing here?" And I answered, "I'm helping her." He asked me for my license. I gave it to him, and after 2 minutes, he asked me to get out of my car and lift my right hand. He put handcuffs on me and told me, "I have an order for your arrest."
Immigration attorney Mark Silverman represents undocumented Salvadorans like Jorge.
We get cases after people have been caught by immigration. They get caught in a variety of contexts. Farm workers get caught merely because they're working on jobs that most Americans won't look at. People get caught in a variety of usually relatively petty criminal offenses. Drunk driving, very petty theft, not paying traffic tickets. Sometimes other people will call in their names. Sometimes they get caught in other workplaces. At any rate, once they've gotten caught by immigration, then at that point, if they have no other immigration possibility going for them, as most don't, the only way they'll avoid an imminent deportation to El Salvador is by filing for asylum. We advise people of that. We say if you are afraid of going back, we recommend strongly you do apply, and we begin to represent them.
Political asylum is requested under the U.S. Refugee Act of 1980, a law based on the 1951 U.N. Geneva Accord on Refugees.
The basic standard is that one should be granted asylum if he or she has a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. One either has to show past persecution or fear of future persecution.
Mark Silverman coordinates the largest of several legal programs that aid Central Americans who seek political asylum.
The San Francisco Lawyers Committee for Urban Affairs administers this emergency asylum program for Guatemalans and Salvadorans. All our legal services are free, provided free. All the representation is provided by volunteer lawyers, volunteer interpreters, volunteer law students. It's really a tremendous commitment on the part of people in this area. There's 70 volunteer lawyers. We can guarantee a lawyer for anybody who's indigent. I think we're now currently representing probably about 110. We've given advice probably to another 70 or 80 more.
Gail Harper, an attorney, and Dion Wilson, a paralegal translator, have teamed up to help Salvadorans apply for political asylum. They are interviewing Ricardo, who fled El Salvador in fear of the guerrillas.
Okay, I made up this direct examination, which we should probably add things to, but it was just sort of my rough thing.
Okay,
how were the other members of your immediate family employed?
¿De qué trabajos tenían sus otros parientes?
Su papá, su mamá.
En el campo. Trabajo en el campo.
Everybody worked in the fields.
Were any of them politically active?
¿Estaban metidas en las políticas?
No.
De ellos?
No.
So was your father a member of Orden?
Pues sí, él estuvo ahí en Orden.
Él estuvo en Orden.
Uh-huh.
Yes, that's true. His father was in Orden.
My understanding is that Orden, that's the death squads. They're the ones who go out and they kill people. Mm-hmm. I mean, does he understand that? Does he understand that Orden is a little bit more to the right than the army? Is he aware of the sorts of things that Orden does?
¿Usted sabe lo que Orden hace?
Lo que le dice el ejército que hagan, eso hacen ellos.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Orden does what the army tells him to do.
Did they ever try to get him to join Orden?
Sí.
Yes.
See, what I'd like to know is what they tell him when they would try to recruit him.
No, pues nomás me dijo, pues.
What they say is, well, what the people of the country would say is, be a man. Don't study because studying's for jerks. And those who study don't want to serve their country.
Servir a la patria. La mayoría casi me conoce, ¿verdad?
And just about all of them knew me, you know.
How did they know?
¿Cómo conocieron ellos a usted?
Por medio de mi mamá.
Because of my mother?
Mi mamá, ¿verdad?
My mom, you know.
Well,
the captains and lieutenants are good friends of hers because she was there for about 2 or 3 years making tortillas for them, you know. She was at the headquarters making tortillas for the army.
Uh-oh, that'll get you killed by gorillas.
Yeah, exactly.
If the gorillas find out that you're feeding the army, they're going to come and knock you off because you're, you know, aiding and abetting the enemy. You're no longer a neutral party. You're part of that. They want to get rid of you because it means that they're going to get killed if you do go and inform on them. Oh, okay, let's go on to the next one. Were any of your friends ever killed by the guerrillas?
¿Fueron unos de sus amigos matados por los guerrilleros?
Sí.
Yes.
And who was that? Who got killed?
¿Quién fue matado?
Le decían Diaper, de mal apodo.
Okay, where did Diaper get killed?
Pues... fue matado en la puerta de la casa donde él vivía.
While he was killed in front of the house where he was living, they say that he was knocking at the door. When a car went by, two shots were heard, and he was shot down by the shrapnel.
Lo mataron.
Does he know who killed him?
Pues, por lo que me di cuenta, como, pues fueron los guerrilleros que lo hicieron, porque...
They say that it was the guerrillas who did it. Because I don't think the army did it, because he didn't have any enemies or anything like that. The only thing is that the guerrillas were mad at us because we weren't involved in this, you know. So I believe that it was the guerrillas that killed him.
Okay, what happened after that?
Me mandaron un anónimo a mí cuando estaba por venirme yo. Me mandaron un anónimo diciendo que yo era el próximo.
I received an anonymous note saying that I was the next one, that I would be the next one to be killed.
So what did he do?
Pues sí, por una parte tenía miedo porque...
On one hand, I was afraid because students are in a lot of danger. Because the army thinks you're with the guerrillas, and the guerrillas think you're with the army. One side or the other, it's all the same. I never joined anything, and I was never interested in fighting for one side or the other. The only thing I was interested in was my studies.
Nunca. Lo único que yo me interesaba era mis estudios.
Ricardo believes the guerrillas want to kill him. Other Salvadorans consider themselves targets of the armed forces and their death squads. Who is killing non-combatants in El Salvador? The left, the right, or both sides? National Lawyers Guild President Mark Vanderhout is an immigration attorney who works with Salvadorans.
The vast majority of the civilian deaths, and by that I mean people not in combat, people being killed, taken out of their house, kidnapped in the middle of the night, and mutilated, are killed by the government, either by the army or by the National Guard, the Treasury Police, or any of the other security forces, or by the death squads that work within the security forces. And I would say, from the information that I've been able to ascertain over the years of doing pretty much work in this area, that it's probably about 99% of the cases.
The data I'm getting is that they're getting it from both sides. These people who get up and they tell you like they know it all, right? That the right, all the people on the right were devils and the guerrillas were angels and the guerrillas were working for the people. And of course they're not going to hurt the people because the people are what they draw their strength from. But that is not what I'm hearing. That they will kill people if they think that those people are going to hurt them. So it's just not as simple as they've been laying it out to be.
There is no doubt that there's some killing going on by the left, but every delegation that's gone down there has concluded that it's targeted killing. They may kill informers. They do go after specific individuals they have in mind. But they don't go after classes of people. They don't wipe out a village because they suspect that whole village of being pro-government, as the government does when they suspect that whole village of being pro-guerrilla. They'll just bomb or wipe out the entire village, line them up against the wall, and kill them all. Women, children, elderly. In El Salvador, they have a situation where the government no longer needs to know anything individually about you in order to kill you. You are under suspicion if you're a member of one of many different groups, either a union member or certainly a union activist, student, peasant, clergy, youth. All those groups, and I've probably left out some, come under suspicion. They're targeted by the government for persecution. I'm representing a family, a mother and a daughter, who came into my office. They had been caught at the border around San Diego. When I asked them what was the reason they left El Salvador, the mother started crying. One night, National Guard knocked on the door about 8 o'clock at night, opened the door, and there's about 8 National Guard sitting outside, standing outside the door. They go in, barge in the door, and make the whole family, the husband, wife, and I think 6 daughters, ranging in age from 8 or 9 to 15 or 16 in that range, lie down on the floor, and then they take the husband outside to the front step in front of the rest of the family, the machine gun to death. They then took out the youngest daughter and each of the 8, I think it was, National Guard men raped her. And they threw her back on the floor. They said, if we see her tomorrow, you'll all be killed. They left and came up here. Chance of them getting asylum is still minimal.
Ricardo lost his asylum case, as do 97% of those who apply. The State Department maintains that the Salvadorans do not have a well-founded fear of persecution. How does one prove a fear? Refugee Program Administrator Dolores Ferguson and INS Director David Ilkert address this problem.
In most instances, the person seeking political asylum from El Salvador simply cannot establish that they have a well-founded fear of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and or membership in a particular social group. And generally that's done through objective rather than subjective evidence. In other words, self-serving declarations, quite frankly, do not carry that degree of persuasiveness that's going to show a well-founded fear of persecution.
They claim people are not presenting sufficient proof of persecution. It's very difficult to bring what proofs you do have in your flight for safety. You cannot go around as a refugee carrying suitcases full of the very documents that would condemn you to death.
There is always some physical evidence available. If a case is based merely upon self-serving declarations, right, that person has a tough row to hold. I mean, granted, many people in their own mind from El Salvador, right, are firmly convinced, have no doubt, right, that if they went back to El Salvador, they would be persecuted, possibly killed, because they've said, well, I've had a distant relative that was killed, and the government's going to make some connection by some vague reasoning that I'm next on the hit list, okay? Some people that can walk down the street, right, and believe everybody's looking at them. Some people are paranoid.
We have had cases extremely well documented, and they're still turned down. You know, it's almost unbelievable. Just to give you an example, we have one client that was a political prisoner last year in El Salvador. He was a teacher, and because he was a teacher. He was considered suspect. He was apprehended by the security forces in El Salvador. He was held in custody. He was tortured. He was finally released. He was threatened again with death immediately after release and had to flee. He left behind everything and is, you know, barely able to survive in the United States. Now he applied for asylum, and he had a tremendous amount of proof. He had a letter from the Ministry of Defense in El Salvador admitting that he was in custody. I mean, proof that he was a political prisoner in El Salvador. He also had ads taken out in Salvadoran newspapers, and this was all submitted in his asylum application, and it's denied. And the reason stated is there's not sufficient proof of persecution. I don't know what more that man could present other than his own death certificate.
I gather the opponents are trying to say that for political reasons, and in order to bolster the government in El Salvador, that the executive branch of the government, right, namely the Immigration Service in this instance, and the State Department, for political reasons, we will not grant asylum, right? We get all types of claims by attorneys that certain persons as a class are being persecuted. I don't think anyone in their right mind can dispute the fact that people are being killed there, but people are killed when you have two armed camps firing each other, and unfortunately, the bombings go on and shelling goes on and civilians are caught in the crossfire. But the Secretary of State is obviously not convinced that the present regime, I shouldn't use the word regime, the present government of El Salvador is systematically persecuting certain groups.
I think we see a real politicization of the asylum processing. It's politicized. To recognize the legitimacy and the validity of refugee claims, claims of human rights violations perpetrated by the Salvadoran authorities would be inconsistent with U.S. foreign policy right now. It can't be admitted that that's going on due to the tremendous amounts of military aid being sent to El Salvador.
These are serious charges against the governments of both El Salvador and the United States. That El Salvador conducts a war of terror against its own civilian population, and that the U.S. ignores and denies these violations of human rights to justify the military aid it pours into that country. What is the reality behind the rhetoric? President Reagan calls the guerrillas in El Salvador terrorists, while supporting guerrillas in Nicaragua, who use terror in their effort to overthrow a revolutionary government. Is one man's terrorist another man's freedom fighter? Is a refugee labeled an illegal alien depending on the kind of government he leaves behind? Attorney Mark Silverman says that there is a double standard behind U.S. policies concerning refugees.
The Department of State has a Bureau of Human Rights, and they make advisory opinions on every application for asylum. By their own statistics, the State Department has rendered negative advisory opinions in more than 97% of the Salvadorian applications. This contrasts sharply with, for example, their very high approval rates on asylum for Afghans. If you're fleeing Soviet bullets from Soviet troops or Soviet-trained troops, and it's essentially Soviet-backed repression, you have a strong chance of getting asylum. If you're fleeing U.S.-backed repression, your chances are slim.
In communist-dominated countries, there is it's recognized there is suppression. Take any communist country you want. You just don't get the degree of free expression that you might get in a Western democracy. And then you show that, yes, because of your position in the matter, you would be persecuted or were persecuted or have a well-founded fear that you will be persecuted, you will be granted political asylum.
The decision to grant or deny political asylum is a matter of life or death. Jorge tells why he fears deportation.
Entrando al pueblo íbamos como a dos metros de mi casa. Cuando bien raro vino.
When I was about 2 meters away from my house, it seemed strange. There was a group of people inside my house. I got scared and I asked myself, what must have happened? As I got closer, I saw black ribbons. Someone had died. I felt very tense because I didn't know what was happening.
Encontré los cadáveres de dos niños, un varón y una hembra.
When I entered, I found the cadavers of two children, a boy and a girl, whose parents had just arrived from the United States. They had been here in the United States illegally, like we are now. Then they were deported to El Salvador. And after 2 months, the guardia arrived in jeeps, well armed, and broke the door down and shot whoever was there, and they killed the children.
Solamente rompieron la puerta y dispararon a quien estuviera ahí, y mataron a los niños.
It was lucky that the mother, it seems that when there was a noise, she went to see who it was at the door, and she shut the door, and they killed only the children. Later, it was said that they were the death squads. There's been many cases, a great number of Salvadorians who come here and are deported, and 2 months later, they are found headless or in pieces on the roads.
Certain groups will allege, make accusations that so many people, and supposedly naming them, have been forcibly repatriated to El Salvador by the government of the United States, and those people are dead now. Well, those claims have been investigated by the Department of State, and in most instances they've been found to be baseless, that the people are alive that were claimed previously to have been killed.
It's hard to document what has happened to the people because it's hard to follow an individual who's returned to El Salvador, and especially if they end up dead, usually their heads are separated from the rest of their bodies, in any case, badly mutilated, and it's impossible to know, really. In a few cases we've been able to track down, we verified some killings by the death squads on deportees. When we put on this trial on the young male case, we had an ex-army officer testify. He was at the airport when a group of deportees arrived, and later on that day, he saw them dead on the side of the road. They had been in government custody. How often that happens, no way of knowing.
According to the U.S. State Department, it is not poverty but communism that fuels the civil war in El Salvador. But Salvadorans who come to the United States are deemed economic immigrants fleeing poverty, not war. Some U.S. citizens, however, feel that Salvadorans are unjustly persecuted by the INS and have a right to remain here. The National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights have filed suit against the Reagan administration in an effort to halt deportations of Salvadoran refugees and prosecutions of parishioners who provide sanctuary for them in churches across the country. The final program of Voices in Exile considers the sanctuary movement. Voices in Exile is a Fine Line production. Claire Schoen, producer. Jim Watson, associate producer. Written by Steve Most. Mixed at the Sound Service by Kim Aubrey. Voiceovers by Herbert Seguenza. Special thanks to Beth Westgard, Amis, the Father Moriarty Refugee Program, and those interviewed for this series, especially the refugees whose names have been changed or withheld to protect their identities. I'm Brenda Berlin.
Alza tu vuelo, confúndete en el viento, haz tu misiva llegar.